Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I have to hate to start with such a gory topic, 5 o'clock in the morning. But
are we discussing your golf game again?
Oh,
too soon.
It hurts all the more because of its accuracy. No, we're talking about, don't blame me, don't blame my golf game, blame Les Moonves and also the Chicago power structure. We'll tackle the second piece, which is seems symmetrical. Ronan Farrow has done it again. He's broken another story and looks like he may take down another media titan, Les Moonves, the head of CBS.
Yeah, Les Moonves has been in charge. He's been an icon there and the leader at CBS for more than 20 years. And I have to hand it to Roa. He has done an excellent job. He's the one who brought down Harvey Weinstein, as you recall, and started this whole Me Too movement by just one report. But this one is pretty stinging. The abuse happened over a period of 20 years and mostly took place in boardrooms when they had board meetings with between Moonves and women.
These are stories, one after another, of varying degrees of severity, up to and including cases in which women say they were pinned down and struggled to escape. These are all stories that happened during business meetings, which I think made it particularly devastated for these working women who expected to be taken seriously. And these are all stories in which women said one after another that they were terrified and intimidated and that they felt their careers suffered as a result.
Moonves.
Rosenstein or Rosenstein?
Exactly. I think I could go either way on it.
Moonves.
Moonves.
312-642-5600 before he gets outed today because they have a board meeting this morning in New York. I wonder what they're going to talk about.
What was that thing again? The what do you hear? Yanni or?
Or Yanni or Laurel.
Laurel or Yanni. Moonves. This recounts 6 women who had professional dealings with him, does Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker, between the 1980s and the late aughts, so as you said, over 20 years.
Yeah.
Forcible touching or kissing during business meetings. I mean, this is the sort of wrinkle with this one that is a bit jarring to me. So you're in a meeting with other colleagues, you're in a meeting with a vendor or a client, you're in the meeting, you're in a board meeting, and
potential actresses for sitcoms.
And let's just start slobbering all over you?
Well, one girl, Elaine Douglas, who's won an Emmy for HBO's 6 Feet Under, she talked about how, you know, she went in there to read a script for Queens, and he interrupts me and asks, am I single? I didn't know what to say at that point. I was like, I'm single, yes, maybe, no. She began talking about the script, but Moonves interjected, asking to kiss her. According to Douglas, he said that he didn't have to tell her manager. It'll just be between me and you. Come on. You're not some nimble virgin.
Oh.
Two of the 6 women told Farrow that Les the Letch physically intimidated them or threatened to derail their careers. In part, this was women who suggested they suffered or were threatened with suffering if they rejected his advances.
Douglas said, in a millisecond, he got one arm over me, pinning me, violently kissing me. And what does it feel like to have someone hold on you where you can't breathe? She said that it was physically horrendous and that she recalled pretty much blacking out. You think, how long is this going to go on? And then she came to and she left the meeting.
And Les the Letch suggests that hey, this is becoming, you know, a cliche when you have so many people repeat the same conduct,
it's
excuse,
same MO.
Defense, it becomes a cliche. What has he said? He said words to the effect of, I may have done some things that made women uncomfortable. Well, that's a big concession.
She said when she got up, her skirt was all twisted. She remembers standing in the hall, and I thought of his family because there's a picture of his wife and kids in that boardroom there, don't you know? And what makes me so sick, remember the Charlie Rose ordeal? Moonves was the first to stand up and say that, you know, we're changing our ways here at CBS. Listen to this.
I think we've been surprised by things that we've seen. But I think it's important that a company's culture will not allow for this.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's the thing that's far-reaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's strange because I know his wife, Julie Chen. Have you seen her?
She's the host of The Chew?
The Talk.
The View?
No, The Talk.
The Rap?
The Talk. She's a woman who, and she made headlines a few years ago because she came forward about her surgery. She's Asian, but she had severe surgery back in the day to make herself look more American. And I'll show you the before and after, but after that, then she was accepted more and got higher roles as an anchor. And then eventually got to CBS Network.
Right, because we haven't seen Asian female anchors in the news business for the last 40 years.
Growing up with Linda Yu, I don't know. But
how about Connie Chang?
Connie Chang. Well, but I'll show you the before and after. It was a big.
You really don't need to. I don't have that much interest. I barely have enough interest in Les Moonves. The only reason I'm interested in him is because he's about to be another leftist entertainment type who is done in by his own boorish behavior. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know what? I have no love for this guy, but you know what? These are only six that have come forward or maybe come
only
forward,
six.
And this guy's been in total control for, let's say, the last 10 years. What about the thousands that he did have fun with that have been moved or promoted in the company? Are you ever going to address that issue? I mean, how many women have taken advantage of guys out there?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I mean, even Amy never explained how she was able to travel with the Cubs when they were in the World Series.
It's so called the press credential.
Have a nice day.
Thanks for calling. That goes back to a well-established love affair Amy had with Yvonne De Jesus in the 80s, I believe. Is that correct?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about CBS boss Les Moonves, who is potentially going to be deposed today at a board meeting. Mm-hmm. Although it's not clear yet. You mentioned his wife, Julie Chen, who's the host of one of those infernal, like, girls talk shows.
It's called The Talk. And Sharon Osbourne is on it. And then the girl from Roseanne.
Yeah.
Sarah Gilbert. Yeah, that's who it is.
Thank you for making my point for me. He said, I recognize there were times decades ago when I may have made some women uncomfortable by making advances. But I always understood and respected and abided the principle that no means no, Amy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never misused my position to harm or hinder anyone's career. Well, that runs counter to what half a dozen women told Ronan Farrow that he memorialized in The New Yorker. And it'd be surprising to me, you know, it started with Harvey Weinstein. It started with a few women that came out, too. And then it turned into dozens upon dozens upon dozens over the course of his career. And so it would be surprising to me in this culture if Moonves survives.
Well, and Moonves should realize, too, that Farrow did a thorough investigation with interviewing all these alleged victims.
And one after another, this is the final point I'd make, they also said that they were speaking out because they were afraid there was a broader culture of impunity across this company, which is something we heard from dozens of people.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you do raise questions in the article about the wider CBS culture. The company says, and this is a quote, "We do not believe that the picture of our company created in The New Yorker represents a larger organization that does its best to treat its tens of thousands of employees with dignity and respect. So what did you learn in your reporting?
And that statement is, of course, in the story. CBS had a really ample window to give input into this, as I always make sure is the case with a story of this kind of importance and seriousness. But we did hear from dozens and dozens of current and former employees that they had seen a culture of harassment and retaliation. And that flowed from Mr. Moonves to different facets of this company.
Oh, poor CBS.
Look, CBS.
Couldn't happen to a better network.
CBS needs to make a move. Put Sheldon in charge.
Oh.
I mean, that's the last thing on Sheldon's mind is the fair sex. He's
exactly.
Focused on his science. Perhaps he could throw in running a network. I'm sure if Les Moonves can do it, Sheldon can do it. I think that solves the problem.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Mark Shields on PBS had a good point over the weekend. That little roundtable he does with David Brooks from the New York Times, Judy Woodruff as the moderator. When the economy is doing good, people focus on other things. When the economy is doing bad, people focus on the economy. In terms of thinking about the midterm elections and the impact on good economic numbers, whether it's low unemployment or robust GDP growth, which we got on Friday, 4.1% in the second quarter. And so it is interesting to note, you think about, if continue on this track and you have 3% GDP growth for the year or leading into the midterms, it's projecting out to be that things going generally well, then that should accrue to the benefit of Republicans and help them maintain control of Congress. And Shields is right that that's not necessarily the case. 4 years ago, the last time we had 4% plus GDP growth, 2014 with Obama, that saw Democrats get wiped out.
Oh, yeah.
Go down to the lowest levels of members of Congress since 1928, continue to hemorrhage state legislative seats. Obama was very good at protecting Obama, but the rest of the Democratic Party suffered as a result. Could we be seeing the same thing with Trump? Well, that's certainly a discussion point for political strategists, but over the weekend, based on the news on Friday, obviously everything was very positive from Republicans that GOP policies are working, which is why, of course, people should stay the course. Mike Pence, he's the vice president, don't you know? He sat down with Maria Bartiromo and had this to say.
The reality is, in the last two administrations, the economy grew by less than 2%. And in the first 18 months of this administration, we were a little shy of 3% last year. We're on track to be at 3% or better this year. And we really believe the internals of these numbers, whether it be the dramatic increase in business investment, a dramatic increase in American exports, all support the conclusion that the policies that President Trump has been advancing, that a Republican Congress has been supporting, are actually working to revive this economy.
The question is the policies that are working to revive this economy, of which Mike Pence speaks, is enough to motivate you to get out and vote to protect even some Republican incumbents? You may be not super excited.
Dragging your feet on?
Well, you might not be super excited to protect, but you know you need them if you're going to have a House control, House Republican control, Senate Republican control. You're going to have a generally friendly Capitol Hill with respect to Trump's policies. Do people connect those dots? Are you,
midterms are 99 days away.
Right. So are you on the center right, are you animated to come out and vote to stop socialism and also to continue to promote Trump's policies and give him the support he needs in Congress to advance policies, things like Tax Cuts 2.0, which has been discussed, but which is not going anywhere unless Republicans maintain control of the House and the Senate, for example. Larry Kudlow was on Face the Nation as perhaps the best spokesman of Trump's economic policies and successes. I think he is, because I think he's also sort of the most real. Mike Pence is a great cheerleader, mm-hmm.
but he doesn't know the numbers like Kudlow.
Well, also, I mean, Did you watch 12 minutes of Mike Pence being interviewed by Maria Bartiromo?
I saw it.
And, I mean, he becomes more and more plastic as the interview goes on.
He's got a little Ivanka Trump in him. Yeah. Where you become memorized and sing-songy, and then you don't see a person. You see a person, but you don't. I can't relate to them. I don't know what it is.
It's.
Or am I getting hypnotized?
There's a little bit of the kind of beltway patter that Pence has that is hypnotizing, because for 12 minutes he's basically saying the same thing, and it's very surface skimmy, and it's sing-songy. It's just he's like one of those guys who's super
yes,
earnest.
Everything's gonna be great. I believe in this man. And
I'm not
the way
saying,
he says it. I don't know what it is. There's something.
There's an earnestness that's a little bit over the top for me. And I'm not saying it's not genuine. But it's just, it's a little one-dimensional. Kudlow, though, going back to Kudlow. Kudlow on Face the Nation on the GDP number.
The basics of this number were consumer spending and business investment. Those are the basics of any number, C plus I, to put it in economic terms. It's doing terrific. It's rising by better than 4%, as was the overall. And I know some people have tried to downgrade this by saying about the tariffs, buy ahead of tariffs. By the way, we don't know that. There's a lot of theories about that. I'm glad to see exports rising, whatever the reason. The biggest thing that nobody's talked about in terms of these smaller issues is inventories. Inventories fell by, I think, $25 billion. That's very unusual. Mm-hmm. It took at least a percentage point off of GDP. But these things jump around a lot. The heart of this report, as I said, consumer spending, business investment are on a tear. Business investment is on a tear, which was really what our tax cuts were designed
right.
to do.
And your deregulation.
And the deregulation, thank you, and the energy. And by the way, the president's attitude, the war against business is over. The war against success is over. The war
but
against
energy is over. But then he's got a trade war.
Well, and I'll tell you what, the war against business is over. The war against success is over. That's an really interesting point that Kudlow makes, because it sets up for a nice contrast between the energy of the left, where that is undergirding the Democrat Party, with, Juan and Eva Perón redux, Bernie Sanders and or Elizabeth Warren, take your septuagenarian Democrat combined with
Maxine Waters,
pick one and then mix in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
AOC.
So,
you know me.
The war against business and success, do you want to restart that war? Or do you want to embrace the sort of the optimistic growth-oriented policies, with the exception of trade, arguably, that have been advanced by the Trump administration? That's sort of a nice, easy contrast. For socialism, against business, against success, for capitalism, promoting growth, opportunity, productive risk-taking. Kudlow went on to also suggest that there may be some additional good news, or some, in my perspective, some good news, period, on the trade front in the not-too-distant future with respect to the pending renegotiation of NAFTA.
On Mexico, just to pinpoint that, we're making very good progress, and something good may be announced in the not-too-distant future.
He also suggested the EU... it's going to go from rhetoric to action soon.
We will have an actual transaction.
On what?
Guaranteed. Starting out right away with soybeans, beef, and liquid natural gas.
So there's your EU. There's your NAFTA renegotiation. And here's Kudlow on China.
Tariffs have moved a lot of people to the table, including the European
Beijing.
Union, including Mexico. Well, we'll see about that. You know, as I said before, a key point here is that all of a sudden the Chinese are being isolated. China, by the way, asked the EU to do a trade deal. The EU said no. The EU said to us, we would much rather have a deal with you, the United States, and that's why President Trump and President Juncker's meeting was so important, and the process is beginning immediately.
All right. Grant in Rockford, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, you two. I would traipse through knee-deep snow to keep that donkey-faced moron bartender from becoming the face of the Democrat Party. She is scary, and she is what they are, but she's just honest about it. Now, as far as the war on success, you didn't build that is over. So if somebody who appreciates hard work is in the office, have a good day, guys.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Grant. Yeah, do you want to go back to you didn't build that? That's maybe even a better handle than the war on business, the war on success. Dan in Libertyville.
As a business owner, I have enjoyed an increase in my business. My customers are having more cash in their pockets to spend on more things than they ever did when Obama was in. And the fact that I don't have to pay over $2,000 because I don't have Obamacare is enough reason to vote for the Republicans in of itself. And to add one last thing, I want Kavanaugh in as a Supreme Court justice, and I want a good conservative in when RPG goes RIP.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dan.
Yeah, and Kavanaugh's meeting with Democratic lawmakers today.
Yeah, let's get that confirmation hearing fired up. Going back to the 4% GDP number for the second quarter and tracking for 3% GDP growth this year, Daily Caller put together a nice little compendium of the experts talking about what was possible. Number one, what would happen if Trump won and then was, you know, in Beltway parlance, how we talk about these things, silly, but nonetheless, if he was in charge of the economy, quote unquote. What they had to say in terms of the optimism of 3% and 4% and 5% GDP growth. Listen to Hillary and Mark Cuban in combination with there's clips in their tweets from all the experts saying that 4%, you know, that. What they were saying to defend Obama, 2% GDP growth is the new normal.
Just like he shouldn't have his finger on the button, he shouldn't have his hands on our economy.
I mean, I have my Trump hedge on. In the event wins, I have no doubt in my mind the market tanks.
So we're going to lose about $11 trillion in tax revenue over the next decade if he does this. And without any cut in spending, it's probably going to require somewhere between 8 and 9% GDP growth just to make us neutral.
The financial markets really are afraid of his presidency. And you know this from, there's other evidence too. I mean, you know, most of the big Wall Street money is going to Hillary anyway. But here you could actually see the reaction of the markets. And he estimated that a Trump win would push the market, stock market down about 10 to 12%.
Ah, the experts.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We all pay attention when in this Me Too era, there's celebrities involved. It could be something so much as leering at me. But if it's high-profile names or names associated with high-profile businesses, we pay attention. We talk about it. And in many cases, the Harvey Weinstein case, the Bill Cosby case, of course we should. When it comes to systemic sexual abuse, particularly of children, whether it's at Michigan State or Penn State or the Catholic Church, we talk about it as well. We should. So I'm struggling to understand why this systemic sexual abuse at the Chicago public school system is getting so little attention. Why this very good reporting by the Chicago Tribune.
And Sunday's Tribune yesterday.
Is getting so little attention. I mean, the stories are jarring. The numbers of stories are jarring. If this was your kid, what would you be saying? If Rahm Emanuel, if this was one of his kids in CPS, what would he be saying? how high would the profile be on this case?
They don't go to CPS schools, please.
I understand.
Oh, my God. God forbid if he had to send his kids to the neighborhood school of Lakeview High School. Oh, my goodness.
If this was happening in New Trier or Hinsdale, how much attention would this be getting?
It would lead the news.
So why not
CPS? For a
CPS?
Week straight. I don't know.
We have a guy, goes for a gun against a Chicago police officer, and we've got 3 days of protests in the street when he's shot and killed. When you have lives ruined within the Chicago public school system, children, as they reported this weekend, the Tribune, special needs children. I hear crickets.
Nothing. Well, the last story was teachers and volunteer coaches to 213 victims throughout several schools.
No.
Throughout the decades. That was like, but this
well,
one's
that was
different.
The, right.
This
that
is
was
about
the first story.
Kids who are abusing other children, and where are the teachers? Where's the principal? Where's the vice principal? Where's the resource officer?
All the layers of bureaucracy. To the extent they get involved in all, they muck it up. So the Tribune reports a couple of examples of what we're talking about here. Two 15-year-old boys, both with autism and developmental disabilities, were in the Bogan High School bathroom alone. Burley sophomore had a history of violent outbursts and sexual aggression. That was one. The other was unable to sense danger. So here's what happened. No one was supervising in 2016 when the towering aggressor told the other student to bend over and pull down his pants before penetrating the boy. No one was watching when the larger boy allegedly attacked the same student two more times that same year. First in the school bathroom, then during an off-campus Special Olympics field trip, also in a bathroom.
Oh, dear Lord.
Three times.
And you think that they have teacher's aid assigned to kids with special needs?
You think they...
So they do it at Blaine. They have teachers assigned.
You think you'd have a handle on somebody who's a problem or a watchful eye. The aggressive student was allowed to be alone with the other boy, even though he had been found 2 years earlier in a bathroom stall with a different boy whose pants were pulled down, according to a pending lawsuit. Is this sick? Yeah, it's sick. Do you want to understand what's happening in CPS? Do you want to confront it, or do we want to ignore it? I mean, honestly. It doesn't matter because it's kids on the South and West Sides? It's not. Not just kids on the South and West Sides. Kenwood. One 13-year-old girl was taking high school classes at Kenwood Academy, which is one of the better schools in Chicago, part of a program for gifted eighth graders, when a star athlete shoved the girl against a wall, exposed himself, and ejaculated. Curry. In 2014, a 17-year-old student lurked in a hallway, grabbed a girl, and tried to force his hands down her pants on two separate occasions, according to juvenile court records. At Orr High School, a special needs boy allegedly forced another disabled boy to perform oral sex in the stairwell. At Gage Park, two male students lured a 15-year-old girl with developmental disabilities into a music room where one unbuttoned her blouse and fondled her breasts, even though she said no, according to the police report. The same student then ordered the girl to her knees, and yes, the boys fled when an adult approached. Culture of sexual abuse. Where are the adults? The report also importantly points out that, as I mentioned, when the adults did get involved, they're beyond their expertise. Stop trying to handle it yourself and go ahead and call DCFS, call the Chicago police, as you're required to do anyway, and turn it over, get out of the way. The Tribune found principals sometimes cast doubts upon victims' stories and subject them to callous interrogations. Family members described the interviews described in interviews and court documents how young victims withdrew emotionally, became perpetually frightened, and in some cases lashed out in anger when they could not express their devastation. Because you got a bunch of people that don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing when it comes to educating children, much less dealing with something as catastrophic as a sexual assault. Does anybody care about this? And the barbarism that is run amok in Chicago that manifests itself in all kinds of ways. Violence in the streets is one we talk about a lot. This system we call the Chicago Public Schools that we continue sending blank checks to. Fill in the amount. Maybe we shouldn't. Since apparently money is the only motivator for anybody to do anything in this state.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Ron on the south side.
Hey, I have repeated over and over, people told me to quit saying it, but I'm going to always say it. I wouldn't let my dog, which is sitting right here next to me, go in one of those buildings. Not only are they not teaching these students, now they can't even protect them. But where's Rahm Emanuel? See, he was with Eddie Johnson with that phony Michael Flager a couple of weeks ago. But see, you know what really hurts me is that my money is paying for this crap. You know, it's sickening. And lastly, yeah, I did read the Tribune covered it in depth. But that paper that's owned by the union people, see, they're not going to expose that because, yeah. See, the teachers union, you know, that's what this is all about. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Yeah, the AFL-CIO Times, you're right.
It just makes me sick that the kids that are most vulnerable, the special needs students, they're the ones who were attacked. They're the ones who need the most protection. And of all the cases, with 40 such cases, 2008, more than half were special needs students.
Opportunity scholarships, anyone? Who'd like an opportunity scholarship? Get their kid out of these schools and to schools that are safe environments to learn. Now, of course, so I'm not accused of not telling both sides of the story. CPS is creating new offices and protocols to deal with these cases. Inspector General Nicholas Shuler's office is to handle adults who assault students. A 20-person Office of Student Protections in Title IX is supposed to coordinate the direct response to student-on-student cases and help connect victims and families to counseling and support. Well, isn't that super?
Well, I will say one thing. They are fingerprinting everyone all over again because I went on Friday
except
after the show.
Except the employees.
No. The employees are getting...
Oh, finally.
So 14,000 employees, because there was a long line, and I thought it was just volunteers who had to get re-fingerprinted. She said, no. We're doing the entire staff. Anybody that goes into the building, if they're, you know, food delivery, they're getting fingerprinted. Janitors, fingerprinted. Even if they work for Airmark and they're subcontracted out, fingerprinted. Volleyball coaches, you, Jacobson, get up here, fingerprinted. But so they're trying.
Yeah.
At least they're doing something. Because volunteers have been,
background checks is, you know, one very small line of defense.
Well, there's see if you have a felony conviction.
Yeah, I understand.
I paid my parking ticket. I'm so nervous.
Yeah, but that's minor. That we're talking about how the actual system operates. So yes, the threshold clearing barriers to entry like fingerprinting and background checks. Okay, fine. What's actually going on inside the walls? And where's the accountability?
Somebody's
there?
Asleep at the wheel there, letting special needs students get molested and raped.
And again, where's the other coverage? Where are the civic and political leaders such as they exist in Chicago and Illinois to talk about this other than to wring their hands? What are you going to do about it?
Now, this would be a reason to shut down 94.
How about imposing discipline in CPS? And what disciplines? Again, the professional educocracy or the education establishment. What disciplines anybody in Illinois? Funding. Or you break up the whole thing, which probably should have been done long ago. Or you do both. But you have to bring a completely new paradigm into CPS. You're not going to... One more bureaucracy within the school system is going to change the culture. It's an adult-oriented system. It is a third-party administrator for the salaries and benefits of the adults in the system. The kids are ancillary. It's not to say there aren't great teachers and administrators and dedicated professionals. It's not to say that. It's a system like a Soviet agrarian co-op that is incapable of success. It is incapable structurally of standing. Pete in Montgomery. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I suppose that we should look at the report that came out, 3 months ago, where the teachers are molesting students?
Yeah.
How can we be surprised if students are molesting students at such a high rate if they have the role model of teachers doing the same thing?
Yeah.
It is a broken system, and there is no, I don't want to say political will, there's no responsible party who could change this. It just doesn't exist right now.
Right. I mean, it's the, thanks for the call, Peter. I mean, ultimately, it's the responsibility of the civilian political authorities and the people they appoint or hire. That's what we're talking about in this system. So, I mean, what's it going to be? I think just the question has to be put to people in no uncertain terms. Mike on the north side.
Good morning, kids. Thanks for taking my call. So they're taking fingerprints. They took them before. Is anyone checking them? This is Chicago. We've got cameras that nobody monitors. Just let me point out the difference between the public schools and the Catholic schools. My ex-wife is a public school teacher, special ed teacher. She does the assessments for the kids, Catholic school kids on the south side. When our daughter was in a Catholic grade school on the north side and my wife was going to volunteer for Girl Scouts, she had to get fingerprinted, pay for her own background check, and attend a class. Even though she was doing assessments for kids at the Catholic schools on the south side, this is how thorough it's supposed to be when it's your kids. Now, the Board of Ed doesn't want to spend the money, you know, unless, of course, it was for a new car for one of the administrators. But maybe we should revisit the whole, what the liberals like to whine about, separation of church and state. Maybe we should give these kids vouchers, because I don't hear this happening in the Catholic schools, kids being taken advantage of like that.
Thanks for the call, Mike. I mean, here's the thing. One, you got the tax credit scholarships that exist now, so there is the opportunity to do just that. $500 million cap over the next 5 years and scholarship funds that can be raised and distributed for kids throughout Illinois to go to different schools. So that's been a positive innovation. I mean, it's just coming online this school year. But what about, you know, the nice thing, the thing I'd like to see the Tribune, other media outlets do, love to do it myself, but they're, you know, cowards, so they're not going to come on this show. Raise your hand. The coalition of effete champagne socialist parents on the north side, like in your neighborhood, Lakeview. You know, always preening about the kids and how funding. You know, they always have the moral high ground. They care so much. What do they got to say about this? I want to hear their defense of this monstrosity that they...
You want them to raise their hands.
They run interference for. Yeah. Come on, step up. Let's see what you got to say. What should be done here?
We're not even talking about this at church, so I know that it's being buried.
We
always talk about social issues at church, and if there's a mass shooting, we pray.
Where are all the SJWs?
We haven't, not once.
Where are they? SJWs and champagne socialists calling all SJWs and champagne socialists, all of Amy's friends. What do you got to say?
Social justice warriors.
What do you got to say? The Catholic Church had this happen too? Yeah, I know. They did.
Watch the keepers.
And they're still... And they're still meeting out justice because of the culture that the Catholic Church allowed to metastasize. Not all of the bishops and hierarchy of the church did, but too many of them. There's no question about it.
McCarrick resigned this weekend.
So there's been a reckoning. Yeah, McCarrick did. So there's been a reckoning that continues. When does the reckoning come to Chicago, the Chicago political class? When does the reckoning come to the Chicago public school system? When does anybody from these constituencies say anything other than write me a check, don't put in an amount? Greg in Schaumburg.
This literally is a leadership issue. When Amy was talking before about the disabled and the special needs kids that are really getting picked on, I just want to give, you know, Willow Creek a big plug right now. 2 weeks ago, they turned over the entire weekend, and they do this every year in August for one weekend where the special needs kids put on a play, and it is just marvelous. And the ministers over there at the entire weekend for the special needs kids to give the parents a break, etc., is amazing. But it took the leadership of the church to recognize that these kids needed protection and then educate people. That's the key.
Thanks for the call, Greg. I mean, do we have to have it on video? Remember the special needs kid who was essentially abducted by those other...
Four thugs?
Yeah.
And then chained to a radiator?
Yeah, he's terrorized for several hours.
They Facebooked it live. They thought they were being cool.
Right. Yeah. Does it have to be Facebook live for us to care about it? For us to be outraged enough to action? I mean, I guess so. At least in Chicago.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
So, Dan, where were you on Saturday for the 8th annual Slut Walk?
Mm-hmm.
What they do is gather.
Stormy Daniels was the Grand Marshal?
No, there's a bunch of ladies and some men that gathered at Water Tower Place and then marched downtown for the Slut Walk to protest sexual violence.
Power to trans people!
Power to trans people!
Power to non-binary people!
Power to drag people, power to non-binary people.
So they held signs and wore whatever clothes they wanted, all in what has been, it's become an annual event, the 8th annual event in many cities to support survivors of sexual abuse and to protest the rape culture. Yeah, the rape culture.
At CPS, you mean?
Oh, no. This is just in everyday
toxic
life.
Toxic masculinity.
Mostly in colleges, ready for another attack on men.
I'm down here because I've lived 41 years on this planet, and I think it's fair to say that a lot of times I don't feel safe walking in the street alone, which is why I travel with a partner a lot. Girls are brought up to be nice, to be unassertive, to make people feel better about themselves. Boys are taught that they're entitled to whatever they want. They can just go out and have it.
Now, Peyton and Eli were with me while I was listening to this, and their hair was on fire. That is not the culture. We know that no means no, because that's what you have to teach anybody, that no means no, regardless of gender. So this walk, I mean, they had a pretty good showing of people that were there. I mean, it wasn't, you know, just a few people. It's an annual event for a reason.
It's great. I'm glad they could assemble that many idiots to keep the tradition going. Iowa Hawk had a great tweet on this. He got into some exchange with a guy about all this trans binary bull jive. 2 points, which perfectly crystallize my own. A, trans people and others with non-conforming gender ID deserve peace and respect and equal rights. B, if you think empirical gender differences are the result of an insidious plot by big patriarchy to foist trucks on boys and dolls on girls, then you're nuts. And B was on display at the Slut Walk, I hasten to add.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Love this song.
I hate to break it to you, that song may have to be changed. The city of Austin, Texas, we're talking about, the capital of Texas, don't you know? Their equity office, the city's equity office, has recommended heretofore changing various street names with historical ties to the Confederacy. 7 streets have been designated as worthy of immediate renaming action.
Hurry, this is important.
Yes.
Because we haven't been able to live with the street names as they are, but now we got to change them.
Too sweet, yes. now.
What are the streets?
The question, the big question is, now what about the state's capital? The namesake of the state's capital, Stephen F. Austin. Should Austin be renamed? The city's equity office says, yeah. Austin had a complicated view of slavery when he and a few hundred settlers settled Texas, essentially. He opposed an attempt by Mexico to ban slavery in the province of Tejas and argued against freeing slaves. So the Equity Office in Austin today is suggesting renaming the city in addition to reporting on the existing Confederate monuments in the city, which, of course, need to be raised.
And he said if they freed slaves, they'd become vagabonds. A nuisance and a menace to society.
Yeah, but it's more complicated than that. He also said things that expressed reservations, if not opposition, to slavery. So it was sort of a political football with respect to keeping settlers there. Because, in other words, Austin essentially said, if the people that I have settled this territory with me will leave if slavery were to be abolished.
And the street names they want to change have to do with William Barton, who was a slave owner.
So, of course, this all relates back to the beginnings of our country, the perniciousness of slavery. That is a dark period in American history. I mean, there's no doubt about it. No one is advocating for slavery here or defending slavery. The question is, do we look at some of these individuals as men and women in their time, or do we look at them today and say it is wrong to remember the Robert E. Lees and the Stephen F. Austins and others, much less to honor them with names on schools, names of towns, names of state capitals?
Well, they need to be present so that we don't repeat history. And I don't like how people think that we can just come and take these statues down and everything's going to be okay. I mean, remember how we got here. It's a footprint of our past. And those statues were up. I do recall when President Obama was in office for 8 hours. And it wasn't a big deal. 8 years, excuse me. Did I say 8 hours?
Yeah, went by so fast.
It did. It was just, I sneezed. And it wasn't a problem. But then you have this event in Charlottesville and what people perceive Mr. Trump to be as a racist comment. Now all the statues are coming down. And God forbid, if the government or the city, local municipalities don't take them down, the people will. Yeah, remember how many they defaced, how many statues?
This was happening before Charlottesville. It predates Charlottesville. It's so much more of an undercurrent than one instance. This is happening on college campuses. This is the left's perpetual calling, is to begin history anew today. That's the danger here. It's not so much my perspective. It's not so much about defending Stephen F. Austin's views on slavery. It's about the effort to rewrite history, to eliminate history, to start here and on a go-forward basis. So to eliminate all the foundations of this representative republic, that's the point. That's the left's point. You have to expunge it all if you want to create heaven on earth, the leftist Xanadu. That's what this is really about. I mean, not for the, you know, mopes who do the chanting and the marching, but in terms of the leftist intellectual set, that's Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That's you know, which is a textbook that's still used all too frequently in public schools. Rewrite, if not expunge, American history for the purposes of us rewriting in our own time based on our own values that have nothing to do with Judeo-Christian values upon which the country is founded, that have nothing to do with the principles articulated in the founding documents, that have to do with, you know, whatever Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez feels like today.
Yeah,
that's what this play is. So what about that? Renaming Austin. Should we view people in their time, or is this a positive step to redress the wrongs, legitimate wrong of slavery, obviously? And is this a way to make sure that that future generations don't look at the Stephen F. Austins of the world as heroes or as people that should be revered? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I've got a solution for this. I don't know if everybody will like it.
I would love to hear your solution.
Would you?
That's right. Why it's called the answer, Dan, because you have answers.
Here's the answer. Every school in America and every town in America should be renamed for Barack Obama. Just name everything Obama.
Remember when they were going to build the high school on Clybourne and name it Barack Obama? Yeah. Obama High?
And I said their mascot should be the Flying Liberals.
Oh, there you go.
Never came to fruition. They changed the name.
Mark in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Foston's going to rename their city, might I suggest Shea, as in Shea Guerrera. But more seriously, this is another example of Orwellian newspeak that was explained in his book, 1984. And any attempts to tear down statues or rename names, we should immediately invoke the 1984 reference and show them where this leads to, because that's exactly where it's leading to, 1984.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Frank in Naperville.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but isn't there something in the Constitution called ex post facto that basically if it wasn't a crime at the time it was committed, you can't be held accountable for it later on? So I don't get this, what these people want to rewrite history about.
Okay, thanks for the call, Frank. George in Barrington.
Dan, I'm beginning to think slavery is the only sin that's ever going to be punished. What about Malcolm X College? Malcolm was a rapist. He was a pimp. He was a drug dealer. He was a burglar, a thief. I mean, that's kind of offensive to drive by and see. And I can remember being in Rush in 94 and to look at the difference between that place now and then. There's been billions poured into that monument.
Okay, thanks for the call, George. I mean, well, this is the point. To do people who are honored for doing one thing have to be saintly in all aspects of their life. Now, you know, there's a continuum here. There's one thing to say, he wasn't a perfect person. Nobody's a perfect person. It's another thing to say that he was, you know, a slaveholder or an advocate for or participant in oppressing people. Those are different things, of course. But again, the question is, do you look at people in their time, or do you judge them by the standards of today, some of which are advancements, and maybe some of the standards of today are regressions? Certainly, the abolition of slavery is an advancement. Some of the other social mores that have become popularized may be not so advanced. Kurt in Bolingbrook.
Hey, guys, good morning. I mean, if you're going to change Austin, why don't they go down the road and go talk to Fort Hood? I mean, how far is it going to go? Are they going to change the names of streets? Are they going to change the name of parks? I mean,
yes.
there's a whole slew of history that is suddenly going to be erased. I mean, I don't think Fort Hood would take kindly to them telling them they want their name changed.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I mean, and it's also, too, even when we name a sports team, comes to mind, in honor of Native Americans, that is not acceptable in the totalitarian culture. So what about all the towns named after Indian tribes or Indian words? If it's not given the stamp of approval by the relevant tribe or Native Americans generally, or just your SJWs even more generically, then do those names have to go too? That's why I think it's a way to just simplify this all is just to name everything after Obama, including the state of Hawaii.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
So a man walks into a convenience store with a gator for beer. That's not the setup to a joke that happened in Jacksonville, Florida, and it was caught on video.
Hey, I see you like a gator stew. Hey, man, y'all got beer still? Y'all got beer still? Y'all
gator.
Ain't out, are y'all? Is he taking the last bit of beer? Are you taking the last bit? Come here, bring your
running around the store or drinking beer?
He's running around the store with the gator. He's chasing the guy who was going to take the last bit of beer, as he said, with the gator, so that he gets the last 12-pack.
It's a lot.
No gator?
Yeah.
Gross.
But here's what I think was actually, I think this was like a little bit of a Jackass
episode.
He said, the guy who posted the video said, all I have to say, it was fun in games. Everybody in the store was friends. and everyone was laughing and having a good time. No one in the situation was scared or mad.
Scared. I'm scared watching. I just got the chills. Its tail is so long.
But you had the gator. You see his mouth is taped, right?
I don't care. He could bust through that tape. Oh, well, what kind of beer did he get after all that?
It's a little fun on a Saturday night in Jacksonville.
Oh, yeah.
That's Florida culture.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Trump meets with the publisher of the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger, who became the publisher when his daddy said it was okay for him to be the publisher now.
Can I take over now?
Please. Sulzberger and Trump both responded to the meeting they had, characterizing it. Trump saying on Twitter that he and Sulzberger discussed, quote, the vast amounts of fake news being put out by the media and how the fake news has morphed into the phrase enemy of the people, sad exclamation point. Sulzberger responded with a 5-paragraph statement issued a couple hours after that Trump tweet saying he accepted Trump's invitation for the meeting, which happened
July 20th
last week, right? Yeah. To raise concerns about the president's deeply troubling anti-press rhetoric. I told the president directly I thought that his language was not just divisive, but increasingly dangerous. I told him that although the phrase fake news is untrue and harmful, I'm far more concerned about his labeling journalists the enemy of the people. I warned that this inflammatory language is contributing to a rise in threats against journalists and will lead to violence. Is that a very real concern? Is that a fair criticism that Mr. Sulzberger leveled in his discussion with the president? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, when there was a fatal shooting, 5 killed in Annapolis, Maryland, at the newspaper there, the first thing I thought of was, oh, somebody that might be inspired by President Trump.
Except it wasn't.
It wasn't. But I just, you know, I mean, he has such vitriol, such hate toward the media that I think he needs to find a new enemy. I mean, I understand why he does what he does. I mean, look, I had a fake news incident on me last week, too, with the Tribune and Mark Kern saying that, you know, that he said something inappropriate. And other people said it was a Me Too movement, but it was my, if it was going to be a Me Too moment, it would have been my moment, which it wasn't. But I gave them a response, Dan, and they didn't put it in. Why? Because if they put that response in, it would have killed the story. Because there is no victim there.
Well, it just.
They finally printed it yesterday.
Do you think Trump really despises the media?
Or is this just a game?
Yeah, I think he. For ratings? I think he utilizes them. I think he understands that it's good to have an enemy, and it's even better if you can select your enemy, and they're a great enemy to have.
Keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer?
No. I think it's selecting an enemy to manipulate to your benefit. So sometimes I use the media or certain outlets to get my message out. Other times they are the message. They are the focus of my attacks for my personal and political benefit. I mean, that this quote-unquote love-hate relationship, I don't think it's love or hate. I think it's strategic.
I think it's a ratings game, but he's not a reality TV show anymore.
Right, he's a politician.
He's a politician.
And you manipulate the media, number one, for your own standing in the public's mind, and number two, for the messaging that you want about yourself and about your opponents. And the media can be a conduit or they can be the target. So what's the problem with that? Trump went on to say that I will not allow our great country to be sold out by anti-Trump haters in the dying newspaper industry. The failing New York Times and the Amazon Washington Post do nothing but write bad stories, even on very positive achievements, and they will never change.
The meeting, by the way, was supposed to be a secret meeting.
Yeah, right. Secret meetings. But I mean, do you really think that Trump hates, or is he manipulating? See, to me, it seems that the ideologue in this relationship is not the president, because President Trump is not an ideologue. It's the D.C. press corps. The D.C. press corps are the ones full of ideologues.
Yeah, but do you think it's, I mean, he still, you know, continues to assail the news media at rallies and then gets people to chant CNN blanks.
Right. So he targets them for his benefit to whip up his base. Why is that different than Obama targeting Fox News to whip up his? What's the difference? The frequency at which one tweeted versus the other? Honestly, I think that people have this all wrong. Peter Thiel points out, Peter Thiel sat down, the billionaire investor tech guru from Silicon Valley, now moving to L.A., and he explained to Maria Bartiromo why he is moving to L.A. But he talks about the negatives of network effect. So one of the reasons Silicon Valley was so successful is because all of the raw materials to build great tech companies were in the same place. Everybody knew each other. Everybody was interconnected. But that can go from a positive to a negative in certain respects. And I would say that a network effect exists, the negative aspects of a network effect that Thiel's talking about with respect to Silicon Valley exist in the D.C. press corps, too, and radiate out to other terrible political press corps like here in Chicago. Here's Peter Thiel.
There are certain pluses and minuses to Silicon Valley. The big advantage is that you have all the talent, all the capital in one place, and so you have these extraordinary network effects. And that's been a motor of Silicon Valley for a long time. But there's a point where network effects go very wrong, and where sort of the network effects, the fact that everyone's super connected, everyone knows what everyone's thinking, everyone ends up thinking the same thing.
So what happened in Silicon Valley?
I do think there's something different when it goes from a large majority having one way to it being almost unanimous, and because things are never unanimous. When people are unanimously on one side, that tells you not that they've all figured out the truth, but that they're in a sort of totalitarian place, that they're in a one-party state where they're not allowed to have dissenting views. And I think somehow Silicon Valley shifted from being, you know, quite liberal to being a one-party state. And those are two very different things.
They are very different things, and Thiel is a very smart guy to point out that distinction. And my suggestion is that how he is describing Silicon Valley could be described, that description fits the D.C. press corps. It's gone from being very liberal to everybody thinking the same thing, almost being unanimity and, of course, thus no tolerance for a different point of view, a totalitarian place, as Thiel said about Silicon Valley. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This being a totalitarian place as well, I will only take calls that agree with me. Kidding. Mike and Big Rock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Big Rock.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, how are you? You know, I just wanted to say that the news media really is who they've always been for decades. They're a very leftist slant, liberal. And I think Trump liked them before he was president. He liked the coverage they might give him. But, I mean, they've gone hysterical now. And, of course, he's going to turn on him. And I think he uses that as he almost uses it as me versus them. And us out here in the heartland, we love it because we know what the news media is. And I think it's to his advantage.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yep.
I'm looking at Big Rock right now.
Mike,
it's outside of Sugar Grove.
I am familiar with it.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. It's on my way to the Aurora Sportsman's Club. Mike is an example of the point I was just making. Mike and Big Rock. Exactly. And you have a lot of people suffering from something that has been now diagnosed, Trump anxiety disorder. Psychologist Jennifer Panning suggesting that the symptoms of Trump anxiety disorder, see if you self-diagnose. You don't need WebMD with us here. Symptoms include feeling a loss of control and helplessness, fretting about what's happening in the country and spending excessive time on social media.
No, I know people who have that still to this day.
Yeah, oh, no question. You go to church with them.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a yoga instructor. She still has it. I saw her over the weekend. She still has it.
Can't find her.
Can't shake it. She can't shake it. She's like,
can't find her Zen
angst,
garden.
Amy, I can't get the angst out.
Yeah. Greg in Frankfurt.
Yeah, am I the only one that sees the irony that the press gets to put forth their narrative, their unsourced stories, their anonymous source stories, and yet when we call them out on it, that's the dangerous part.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Thanks for the call, Greg. That's the danger is that the totalitarian veil will be pierced. Now, I mean, the idea of making threats against journalists or suggesting people do harm to journalists or anybody else. But the idea that journalists are some protected class, you know, they're very self-referential and it's a little insufferable, frankly. Russ in Elmhurst, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I love you guys. Amy, hi. I'm glad you're feeling better. Anyway, I was going to say basically the same sort of thing. I believe that that the bulk of the media will always be our enemy. They are nothing more than an extension of a Goebbels-like attitude. They always will be, and that's what the Marxist socialists have always been. They just hide behind names, and they're not liberal. They are not liberal. They've never been liberal. They only cop the people that they can use, whether it's by color or by their choice in life. That's all. They don't care about anybody. They just care about power and control, and that's it.
All right. Thanks, Russ. Derek in Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Hey, morning, guys. To touch on Greg's point, the level of being offended and their self-righteousness is off the charts. Like Greg said, for 30, 40, 50 years, they've pushed a narrative, and then when Trump calls them out on it, oh, how dare you? How dare you? And I honestly do think that the press corps, a free and independent press corps, is supposed to be an advocate for the people, not the government. And when they don't employ their free and independent nature, they do become an enemy of the populace. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Derek. Appreciate that. I mean, the Fourth Estate, right? That's the press, the Fourth Estate.
Right.
The origins are the European concept from the European concept of the states of the realm, the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners. The press was the Fourth Estate. A check as well as a scrivener for the other three estates. Do you think that they're a check on the nobles in 2018 America? Are they living up to that? You think they're representatives, defenders of the commoners, scriveners of their stories? You know, maybe if you get shot, they'll record that. It's about their utility. Tim in Naperville.
Hey, Dan and Amy, great show. I got a question. This editor, very concerned about his reporters that might meet some hostility. Did he show the same concern about the people that support Trump when Maxine Waters is advocating getting in their face at restaurants and giving them no peace wherever they are? Did he show any concern at all for Trump supporters?
Yeah,
that's
a great question, Tim. Thanks for the call. You know, that was not disclosed by either party in that meeting, so I don't know. I suspect the amount of navel gazing that somebody like A.G. Sulzberger does prevents him from being concerned that others may be targeted for their political beliefs. Were they so concerned about the IRS targeting people for their political and religious beliefs in the previous administration? For President Obama demonizing people that are faith-based or gun owners, that are the kind of the hillbillies, quote unquote, that J.D. Vance memorialized in Hillbilly Elegy that helped Trump to victory in 2016? Yeah, probably not. Mark and Joliet.
Hey, good morning, Amy and Dan. The way that I see it is that the press is finally getting as good as they give. They create international boogeymen out of cake bakers in Oregon and Colorado.
Huh.
They put my friends over in Walkerton, Memories Pizza, out of business permanently. They manipulate 911 tapes to make a guy defending himself in Florida look like a racist. They hide stuff about Democrats like Obama, but, you know, lie about conservatives. They're finally getting as good as they give.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Good points about the cake bakers and Memories Pizza in Indiana. Yeah. Where do these individuals go to get their reputations or businesses back after they've been maligned wrongly in the press? How many examples of that do we have? Misreporting on topics that cause material harm to people, long-lasting, in some cases irreversible. Excellent point. Megan on the South Side.
Hi, good morning, you guys. I just wanted to chime in. I happened to catch a thing on Netflix where Jerry Seinfeld goes around interviewing comedians.
Yeah,
and he interviewed
cars.
A kid from
with
yeah. He interviewed a kid. It's pretty good. He interviewed a kid from The Daily Show, and he asked the kid. He said, "What's the best?" I don't remember the kid's name, but he said, "What's the best part of your job, working there?" And he said, "Oh, the best part is when I come in the morning and the crew presents us the top six stories of the day, and we the staff and the writers sit around and debate them, and we get all the different points of view and da da da." And I just thought it was so funny because they obviously don't have different points of view. I mean, they're told what to report, and then they talk about the angle to take amongst themselves. That's not debate.
Yeah, they debate which Trump joke is better than the other Trump joke, right? Yeah, thanks.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Megan.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Get your free tickets to meet Sean Spicer in Chicago on August 8th. Go to 560theanswer.com/briefing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it's the thing that I'm most upset about Trump over is surrounding himself with these low-rent individuals like Michael Cohen, because it forces us to have to endure exposure to more low-rent individuals in cases like this. So, for example, this oleaginous Michael Avenatti.
Oh, he's like a sore that won't go away, if you know what I mean.
Truly, and he's got his own colorful past. That's not relevant, so we'll stick to what's relevant. Avenatti on MSNBC over the weekend talking about more clients that he has, unnamed to this point, three in number, who were also paid hush money by Trump, perhaps through Cohen, and they will be disclosed in all due time.
There are three additional female clients of mine that had not been disclosed that were paid hush money prior to the 2016 election, whether it be from Michael Cohen on behalf of the president, an entity that Michael Cohen formed, or AMI. That's what I'm saying.
But those women had relationships with the president, with Donald Trump?
Well, last time I checked, they weren't just handing out checks to anyone, whether they had a relationship or not.
And last time I checked, even if they did have a relationship, and even if they were paid money to not disclose it, and I'm not defending the morality of such behavior, we understand, and I've said on this show any number of times from the outset of his candidacy, Trump is a known cad, so I'm not celebrating it. But last time I checked, nothing of what Avenatti has described rises to the level of criminality. So what is it the Southern District of New York is looking for? Well, for more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Ron Hosko, former FBI Assistant Director, now the President for the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Ron, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you. I picked up a new word recently. It's oleaginous.
That's a great word, isn't it? That's a fun word. And it has wide application when you talk about politics. So, yeah.
This has wide application in this case that we're talking about.
There's no question. And so what as somebody who would obviously work in consultation and collaborate with U.S. attorneys, What is the Southern District's play here with Cohen and Avenatti and the American Media Group and the possible payments of hush money?
Well, right now it's a little bit opaque to us. I think these guys are doing what they ought to be doing, which is working quietly behind the scenes. We hear some leakage about the case. I don't think from the U.S. Attorney's Office. I don't think from the FBI, but from the attorneys and the parties involved, who are all, I think, posturing and trying to, you know, find some PR high ground in what is a quagmire. You know, who slept with who was paid for and for what, who has possession, who has knowledge. You know, it seems like we are in a constant battle. We get to listen to it between the attorneys, between some of the parties. Certainly, Mr. Avenatti has been the most outspoken. I will say he speaks in a manner that suggests he is very confident in his information and in his position. So does that reveal that he truly does have additional witnesses, and more to the point, what, if anything, do those witnesses add to this case? We don't have a president who's on trial. We don't have a president who is likely to face criminal charges or criminal indictment from Bob Mueller per DOJ policy. So what, at the end of the day, do we have? I would say at least we have a bunch of witnesses who lack aspects of credibility. If you ever get to the point where there are charges, I would not expect that Bob Mueller would proffer any kind of criminal charges on the testimony alone of a Michael Cohen. He would be looking for additional information that validates anything that Cohen says, and probably be looking to do that two or three times over to prop up Cohen as a witness. So, we should have no expectation Bob Mueller is going to bring any charge based solely on unvalidated testimony of Michael Cohen.
So is there a violation of campaign finance law? Because by paying them off, essentially, he was influencing the election.
Well, that's not.
But that's one line of argument that I heard.
That is a line of argument, and we're going to have to wait to see. Is there state of mind information there? Is there evidence of concealment? I think, you know, those factors would make a potential campaign violation charge much stronger.
Right, but so the campaign finance violation would be like Michael Cohen making a donation above the limits. Or failure to disclose. So to your point about state of mind, you'd have to know that Trump knew what Cohen was doing and why he was doing it to skirt campaign finance laws. But I just don't believe that the Southern District of New York, the play here is a campaign finance case. The play is what Andy McCarthy has said. It's an extortion case. But there's just nothing that's been presented. I mean, again, we're talking only what's available in the public sphere. Nothing that's been presented that makes out either one of these cases.
Right. That's the difficult part from us. We are seeing, I believe, a small fraction of what Bob Mueller possesses and of what the Southern District of New York possesses. So, we're just engaging, as is Andy McCarthy and so many others, engaging in fairly rank speculation. We don't know the strength of the witnesses. We don't know the strength of documentary evidence, transactional information, whether it's phone calls, text messages, banking information, travel records, all of which these guys are going busily about their job collecting. And now we hear reflections of the Southern District trying to go deeper into Trump's friends with other notables. I think it is the National Enquirer, publisher or producer. And so, look, this is part of what Mueller is trying to do. And I know we've talked about it before, how long it takes to get to the core information. Who are the key people? How do you get there? And how do you convince someone that you will be my witness if I'm Bob Mueller, I'm the U.S. attorney in Southern District?
Speaking of Mueller, how important is the Manafort trial to his larger investigation that the Manafort trial, which commences this week?
You know, to me, it's only important in one significant way, that it is additional pressure on Manafort to cooperate, because he's going to face what could amount to a life in prison sentence if he's convicted. My supposition would be, based on reading the information or the indictment. The indictment is strong. It lays out a strong case. There is very likely ample proof to convict. And so this is the continuing squeeze on someone that Mueller would see as a logical nexus between the campaign and Russian influence because of the work that Manafort did. So I think it is a continuing squeeze. And if Manafort comes across, well, first, you know, the essential question is, does Manafort have something that hurts the president, that hurts others in the campaign to make the bigger case? We don't know that. We don't know that. Manafort's holding steady to his innocence. I think based on the indictment and knowing Mueller and some of the people on his team, he is very likely to get a conviction. Mm-hmm. And then what?
Then hopefully the president could pardon or commute his sentence.
Well, why would the president have to do any of the above? I mean, that would make no sense. Why would he do something like that when that would almost feel like he's trying to cover something up? And this is all Manafort's business dealings. This has nothing to do with Trump.
But that's what this deals with. It is strictly an indictment charging Manafort. It does not charge him in a broader conspiracy. But I think first, Manafort, you know, just from a taxpayer, taxpaying public member of the public perception, made some horrible mistakes here, and just thumbed his nose at U.S. tax law.
Yeah,
the expectations for all of us to contribute our fair share. He did that in a flagrant way. I think he's likely to be convicted, but it doesn't reflect necessarily on any kind of Russia scheme with the campaign.
Right.
But it's Paul Manafort standing alone.
Just because Manafort thought he could behave like a Russian oligarch doesn't mean that Trump was colluding with the Russians. I mean,
Exactly right.
Let me ask you another question about Mueller. This report last week that he's re-reviewing Trump's tweets as it pertains to Comey and others. Yeah, those kind of press accounts, whether they're true or not, they don't exactly inspire a lot of confidence that the Mueller investigation is onto a substantive track.
Well, I don't disagree with that. You know, look, I think Mueller is obligated absolutely to look at obstruction of justice in whatever form it appears. Is it some, you know, a weave of tweets and private conversations? I think he's beyond Twitter. He's not one that's given to documenting a lot of what he does electronically. So what kind of picture does that present? And I think perhaps one of the challenges for Mueller here is if he is to charge people with some form of collusion or write a report that suggests the president obstructed justice, it needs to be pretty darn compelling, because we have a very divided public on these issues. And so, you know, if you're agnostic and you just want to know the facts, you know, I want a compelling case if you're suggesting the president of the United States conspired to obstruct justice, obstructed justice, took other steps. You know, that better be strong. And
well,
I think that's true of any case against the president.
And the additional problem that Mueller has with obstruction of justice is that you've had arguably exculpatory statements offered on the topic by Comey and McCabe and others that, no, he didn't feel pressure to do anything. No, I don't think he interfered. I mean, this isn't verbatim, but that's essentially what Comey, for example, has said previously with respect to the Russian collusion investigation. So, that's a pretty high bar for Mueller to clear if there's going to be an obstruction case made out.
Well, and you also have the Rosenstein memo that basically gives the president the justification for the firing. So once again, the question goes back to what was the president's true intent here? And in a couple of things that he has said and done, some would say he's revealed his true intent. It's to take the Russia investigation off track and you know, to abdicate or to quit any kind of charges against Mike Flynn, to basically make this thing go away.
Yeah, but this is the chicken and egg problem that Mueller has, right? If he obstructed justice by trying to derail the Russian collusion investigation, you have no evidence of Russian collusion, and you've got conflicting evidence at best of any effort to obstruct. And then you have the additional legal argument offered by Dershowitz and others that it doesn't matter what the president's intent was, because he's well within his right to fire Jim Comey because he doesn't like the color of his tie. It's an executive appointment. And so that is a lot that Mueller is up against, which is why you can understand the likes of Trey Gowdy, who are inclined to be very protective of the FBI and DOJ, have sort of run out of patience with Mueller.
Yeah, well, again, I think that we would be making a mistake if we let the politicians decide.
Agreed.
The pace of a criminal investigation. That's a huge mistake. And you know, certainly if the sides were flipped here, the voices would be flipped as well, right? If it was Hillary Clinton, President Hillary Clinton under investigation, a lot of folks would be saying exactly that, you know, the teams would be reversed. You know, the those on the right would be saying, hey, let this thing reach its logical conclusion. So I think my supposition is Mueller's moving as quickly as he can. He will bring it to some logical conclusion in a relatively near term. And some of these pieces will fall into place. You know, does Manafort with a conviction fall into place and Manafort say, look, I don't want to spend the rest of my life in federal prison. I'm going to tell you everything I have to avoid that result. Or does Manafort say, I know nothing. I can't help you because
right.
I have nothing. And right. and Mueller can't challenge it because he has nothing to the contrary to crack him open. You know, that's going to happen in the near term, I think.
Does
a major piece fall into place or does that major piece not exist?
All right. We will find out at some point in some distant star. Ron Hoskow, former FBI assistant director, now the president for the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Ron, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Oh, he's bad to the bone, all right. This quite possibly was one of the most disgusting stories we've ever told, but we've got an update. This is about the superintendent,
right,
in New Jersey.
Oh, jeez. My God.
Thomas Tramagalini, pretty young guy. And, you know, this is what unfolded. Their track practice, you know, it happens in the springtime, and a lot of the players, track team members, were stumbling over human feces. They thought maybe it was a droppings from a Great Dane, a St. Bernard, or possibly an Irish wolfhound. But it was a daily occurrence, and the poops would be all over the football field and the track.
You know, my dog doesn't like to go in the same spot either.
So they put up surveillance cameras.
Yeah.
And can you imagine looking at the surveillance saying, oh, yeah, we got a hot one. You got to check this out. It's the superintendent of your school district.
Yeah.
Popping
a
squat, dropping a deuce, then circling around and kicking afterwards.
Yeah.
And not picking up his own feces.
Then scampering away.
So
he likes to do it on naturel.
They picked him up at 5:50 a.m. on Monday, April 30th, and let him know that he was caught in the act. But basically, he's going to resign. But he's also suing the police department for $1 million because they put out his mugshot. And they said of what he did was the equivalent of a speeding ticket. And you don't put out mug shots. It was kind of a shaming tool. That's what the attorney claims.
Well, that's a public event, and that's a public mug shot. But that's accessible to the public. The real question, of course, that I'm most concerned about.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure he's still going to get his pension.
I'm sure. Oh, that would be the sad thing.
Oh, good. Yeah, no. Just as long as he gets his pension.
I wonder where he's pooping now.
Probably Tim Hortons in Canada. They're pooper friendly. I understand.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and I'm a little concerned. I
am too.
I don't know what's going on. Do you have a Sunny without Cher?
Do you have a Laverne without Shirley?
A Peaches without Herb.
A Mork without Mindy.
A Captain without Tennille.
A Dan without Amy.
You don't. So a Silk without a Diamond? We're going to find out what that sounds like. Diamond and Silk, host of the Viewer's View, former Facebook users before they were summarily dumped by Mark Zuckerberg. And now, is there trouble in paradise with Diamond and Silk? Joining us, Silk from Diamond and Silk. Silk, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having us. Listen, every time you see Silk, there's a Diamond. And every time you see Diamond, there's always a Silk.
All right.
Was she okay?
It seems like in a metaphysical sense, maybe.
No, everybody is good. We've been doing a lot of traveling, getting prepared for our movie, Dummycrats. So you can go to dummycratsthemovie.com. And today is another travel day. So you have Silk today. So let's do part of an interview since you got part of it, okay?
We just want to make sure everything's okay. We love you guys.
Do you miss Diamond?
I mean, I'll see Diamond in a few. It's no biggie.
All right.
They're sisters. They were each other's first friends.
We're blood sisters. That's right.
Yeah, it's like Reagan and King's Row. Where's the rest of me here, Silk? all right, let's get to it. This is interesting. You know, one of these stories that we need pundits like yourself, you and Diamond, to amplify. It's just incredible. This was a story we covered here about the IRS rehiring a bunch of individuals who maybe didn't have the best track record at work. One example, the fire worker with several misdemeanor theft convictions and one count of felony possession of a forgery device. You think maybe you don't want him at IRS. Well, he was rehired. 11 employees previously disciplined for unauthorized access to taxpayer accounts. Maybe you don't want them rehired. These are all individuals, the Daily Signal reports, who were rehired by the IRS. Now there's legislation that's been introduced by Kristi Noem, a Republican from South Dakota, that would prevent the IRS from rehiring these people. But the IRS is resistant and, frankly, dismissive of the legislation, saying we have our own house under control. Don't you bother none. And it seems like this has been really one of the areas of failure for both Trump and the Republican Congress, is doing more to reform the IRS, knowing the abuses that took place before Trump's election.
Well, you know, when I listen to what you just said, first off, who's doing the rehiring of these individuals? Who's getting kicked back, patty whack, and which dog is being given a bone here?
Yeah.
Because why are you hiring back individuals that have did damnable things to individual accounts? Why are you doing that? It's for a reason. It's no different than this judge up there in Chicago that is allowing these sanctuary cities to be funded, which house criminals right up there in Chicago. And then they want to say that, okay, we've done some justice to our safety. Please give me a big break.
I like the nursery rhymes. We don't get nursery rhymes from Diamond, so I like that. So that's going to be your trademark.
Last week I thought of you two ladies when Facebook's stock tanked, biggest drop in the history of the stock market. What did you two do to celebrate? Because, I mean, honestly, I think that their stock was tanking over the censorship, and then naturally I think of you two.
Well, one thing about Diamond and Silk, we do not gloat at anybody's downfall. But this is what karma looked like. You may not pay what you owe, but you're going to reap what you sow. We already said that Mark Zuckerberg will be the face without the book and the book without the pages, because he got to get this mess together right here. If you're supposed to be a platform for all, a neutral platform for all, even though you are a private company, you're still open to the public. So imagine this. Imagine going into a grocery store that's privately owned and they all sell white milk. You can't sell that jug of white milk to just one group of people. I don't care if you are a private owned store. That's just the bottom line.
Have they let you guys come back online, or what's going on?
Well, it's not that we're offline. What they are doing is suppressing our reach, meaning we have almost 2 million followers, authentic followers online. And what they are doing is not allowing the individuals to see our posts. They're not sending out notifications, so actually they're breaching their own policies by not sending out notifications to those individuals whenever we drop content. They want to make it look like no one is interested in our stuff. And let me tell you all where this is coming from. There's a lot of people that is no longer looking at the mainstream media. And they wanted to see, how did Donald Trump win this last election? He won it through social media. So now that the left is saying, okay, he won it through social media, who are the top people, the individuals? Well, Diamond and Silk are known as internet stars, okay? So now let's see how we can suppress the top, the individuals, so that they won't be able to have a voice here. And then also, if you look at this, this is part of the Democrat tactics. This is something they've always done. When they see that you're doing something different from them, different from their narrative, the first thing that they want to do is take your money away. See how they can cut the legs from under you. If Mark Zuckerberg was a Republican and Diamond Silk was Democrats, Democrats would be all out in the streets calling him all types of racist, talking about no justice, no peace. This man took, we had a business, this was a business, and there's so many people that have built their businesses on Facebook. This man business, they have taken our business from underneath our feet because they don't like what we say.
You're on Twitter as well, Diamond Silk, and
for now.
Well, right, and that this whole issue of shadow banning that has returned. Mm-hmm. Some of this was exposed with some of the James O'Keefe undercover videos where Twitter employees were talking about how they shadow ban conservatives. But now there's some interest in Capitol Hill, including with Devin Nunes, the House Intel chairman. And he mentioned over the weekend in an interview with Maria Bartiromo about possibly looking at legal action against Twitter for shadow banning conservatives. Now, I think, you know, maybe there's an argument to be made that you have a contractual case with respect to full disclosure if you're going to treat one customer different than another and inconsistent with the terms of use. But mm-hmm. but are you worried at all about Republicans wanting to use the law to direct private media who and what content they should accept and promote and how and in what ways they should do it?
Well, we got to first see if they violated any type of election rules because you are given a platform for Democrats to voice their voices, but you're not doing the same for Republican voices to do their same. So to do the same. So it's some stuff that's happening with shadow banning on Twitter, on Facebook, and YouTube. You know, we have 180,000 subscribers on YouTube, and even YouTube is shadow banning. They're not allowing individuals to see our videos. With those 200,000 individuals that we have, only maybe 10 to 15,000 people see our videos. So the shadow banning is going on all the way across the board. And like I said earlier, it's because the mainstream media narrative is no longer getting out. Nobody is no longer listening to the mainstream media. Everybody is getting their sources from the internet. So that's why they want to shut it down. And I believe, I'm glad that that Devin is doing what he's doing. I hope that more people jump on board, because when Diamond Silk tried to tell everybody what was going on, you had people from the left and even some from the right saying, "Oh no, this is a hoax. They are lying. They are over exaggerating." Now they see how it feels.
You ladies have a lot of influence, or strong influence, over American citizens. And what are you doing to prepare for the midterms? Because now they're 99 days away.
Well, what we have to do is continue to tell the truth. We have to continue to educate. That's why we're coming out with our movie, Dummycrats. We're featured in a movie, called Dummycrats. You can go to dummycratsthemovie.com. You can put in your email and address so that we can keep you updated and informed. The movie come out this fall, and it talks about the hypocrisy. While our president is draining the swamp, Diamond and Silk is going to be exposing the swamp. We're going to be exposing the hypocrisy that's going on the left, how they say that this man is not doing this, this, and this. Look, we're at a 4.1 GDP, okay? The different things that they want to take and down this man for, while they sit on the left, talk about hoes, sluts, and prostitutes. We over here on the right talking about growth, talking about people having jobs, talking about black unemployment being as low as ever in the history. That's what we need to continue to keep out there. And if you don't vote right, you will get left.
And Trump over the weekend was talking about a couple of things. One of them, border wall funding, and that he would be willing to, you know, quote unquote, shut down the government. That, you know, these things are phony shutdowns. But nonetheless, making his point that border funding is a must have for him to go along with any forthcoming budget from Congress. Do you think that's the right play for Trump to make?
We have to do what we have to do. It's time for American safety to be put first. It's time for America House to be safe again, because it's not fair that the Congress, we send Congress there to do a job, and when they get there, they sit on their hind parts and do nothing. They're there to protect the American people first, not illegal aliens. So they need to get off their hind parts, work with our president, and follow his agenda and put forth what is best for Americans by putting Americans first, not illegal aliens.
She is Silk from Diamond and Silk. They will be reunited. You see what I did there, Silk? They're one of the hosts. They're the host of The Viewer's View. Mm-hmm. Also, the movie. Tell us again, Silk, where you go to get information on Dummycrats.
Dummycratsthemovie.com.
All right, Silk. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you all so much for having us. Have a great one.
You too.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Uh-huh.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, it's almost football season. This is a very difficult story for me because I hate the Cowboys. Hate the Cowboys. Diehard Steelers fan,
don't.
Of course. Yeah. Despise the Cowboys, want them to lose every game. But Dak Prescott, who's the quarterback for the Cowboys, don't you know?
What happened to Tony Romo?
Yeah, he's no longer playing.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah, of course.
I'm playing dumb blonde.
You're up on the game.
Well, I know more than women, more women about football.
That's so misogynistic.
That's so bad.
Why does it have to limit it to women?
You know what? I bet I know more about football than certain people nearby.
Well, Justin?
As I look into a room of three men.
Well, sure. Well, yeah. I mean, anybody.
What's first and goal?
Anybody who comes to work on a skateboard, you know more about football than him, obviously. Okay. So Dak Prescott, I never protest during the anthem. I don't think that's the time or the venue to do so. The game of football has always brought me such a peace, and I think it does the same for a lot of people. A lot of people playing the game, people watching the game, people that have impact on the game. So when you bring such a controversy to the stadium, the field, to the game, it takes away from the joy and the love that football brings a lot of people. Of course, there's nothing that brings more joy and love than seeing grown men smash each other. And so it's very peaceful. It's serene. I mean, maybe if you go to a Bears game where there's no tackling and no scoring, at least from the home team, it's a little bit more serene. But Dak Prescott, he's not down with the whole Colin Kaepernick, Cuba-loving Che Guevara business.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, your reason. I like Jerry Jones. That's why I like the Cowboys.
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I like Dak Prescott personally now, but I still hate the Cowboys. And your son's going to play football this year.
Peyton has signed up to play football at Amundsen High School.
Is he going to take a knee during the anthem?
No. We don't know if he'll be on the team. I mean, he's got to try out. He's got to, see if he's football worthy.
I mean, Amundsen. They have girls
it's
on the team, don't
Amundsen,
they?
It's called Amundsen, not Amundsen, whatever, first of all.
Whatever.
And it's going to be a successful party. It's going to be a long fall, Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially for Peyton.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
It'll be fine. Yeah. Sure.
No, it's going to be great.
I've been through that.
What could go wrong? Oh, you played football in high school?
No, my oldest son did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did he play at Amundsen?
No.
It's Amundsen.
He played at Riverside Brookfield.
Oh, an actual high school.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Michael Avenatti continues to tease out information he thinks he has against the president that's going to take down Trump for the purposes of building his slimy law practice, it would seem to me. But Avenatti over the weekend saying that Stormy Daniels isn't the only arrow in his quiver. He has three more undisclosed clients who have been paid hush money by Trump.
There are three additional female clients of mine that had not been disclosed that were paid hush money prior to the 2016 election, whether it be from Michael Cohen on behalf of the president, an entity that Michael Cohen formed, or AMI. That's what I'm saying.
But those women had relationships with the president, with Donald Trump?
Well, last time I checked, they weren't just handing out checks to anyone, whether they had a relationship or not.
Oh, he's so provocative.
Yeah, you know, anything I'll say in his defense, sort of, is Trump's caddish behavior brings out the parade of horribles like Michael Avenatti and Stormy Daniels and others, sort of a mess of his own making. But that doesn't mean it's criminal, and that doesn't mean there's any case for impeachment or prosecution of some other sort with respect to the president. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by famed Harvard Law professor and the author of the book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump. He is Alan Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks. You know, the Avenatti show is very much a sideshow. It has really nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. As long as President Trump isn't foolish enough to do what President Clinton did, namely to testify under oath about his sex life, it basically is nobody's business. The voters have a right to take that into account in deciding who to vote, but it's not the business of prosecutors or anybody else. People want to have sex with other people and pay the money not to have it revealed. That's neither a crime or a tort or a violation of any contract.
Right. And so what do you sense as the Southern District of New York's play here with Cohen and, I guess, by some extension, Avenatti and the American media company, the National Enquirer Media Group? It seems that the only play for that, there's two potential criminal acts that could have been committed potentially. Campaign finance violation or some kind of extortion racket to silence Trump paramours.
Well, it would be, if it was an extortion racket, it would be extortion the other way. If the person who pays the money is usually not the extortionist, it's the person who demands the money. I mean, let's put all this in context. Nobody is claiming that the alleged sexual encounters are anything but voluntary.
Right.
And why are we making heroes out of women or men who have voluntary sexual encounters and then get money for it? And then, not satisfied the money they get, seek more money for it. That's not a commendable activity in general. And yet, because people who are out to get Trump will take anything that they can get, they make heroes out of Avenatti and the women who are asking for more money for a consensual sexual activity. I just don't get it as a matter of general morality. Why we are making heroes out of these folks.
Well, speaking of morals and maybe a lack of morals, attorney Michael Cohen, who in their right mind, I have never heard before of an attorney taping a conversation with anyone. Did he do it to hope, like, to try and blackmail President Trump down the road, or why would he need that tape or want it?
Well, to take the best possible case scenario, I can imagine a situation where a lawyer needs to protect himself against the client, where he thinks the client maybe will change the story or go after him, and so he does it to protect himself. That's the best case scenario. I don't think it's the right thing to do to be taping your client, but I can understand it. The real question is who leaked the privileged tape, and then we need to know the answer to that. And nobody seems to be interested in getting to the bottom of it. Remember, the tape was leaked. The content of the tape was leaked before Giuliani waived the privilege, but after a former judge made a determination that it was privileged. So the question comes up, why was it leaked, and who leaked it? Who benefits from the leak? Remember, if you can leak lawyer-client confidential information, you can also leak conversations between a priest and a penitent, a doctor and a patient, a psychiatrist and a patient. That's a very dangerous precedent to set. We ought to be preserving confidentiality. None of us should have heard this conversation. This conversation was entirely legitimate and privileged, and yet we know the content, and that's because somebody leaked it.
And if Cohen was the leaker, then he should face disciplinary action, if not disbarment.
Well, but we don't know who it was. We don't know that it was Cohen. We don't know who it possibly could have been. There are many people. I mean, we all have theories, but they're not worthy of putting out publicly because they're just theories.
Well, the Paul Manafort trial begins this week, and there's
it's not the Paul Manafort trial. It's the trial of Donald Trump. As Judge Ellis, who presides over the trial, said, nobody's interested in Manafort. Nobody would have ever gone after him for these alleged crimes. What they're trying to do is squeeze him. And as he pointed out, sometimes people who are squeezed not only sing but compose. And here you have the judge presiding over the trial who himself said, nobody's interested in Manafort. They're only trying to get him to testify or provide information against President Trump. And yet civil libertarians seem to love this. I mean, if the shoe were on the other foot, if it were Hillary Clinton who were being prosecuted, if she had been elected president, every civil libertarian would be jumping up and down in anger at the way this is being conducted. And yet the civil libertarians, including the American Civil Liberties Union, are very, very quiet, which is one reason why I, as a liberal Democrat who voted for Hillary Clinton, am speaking out so much, because nobody else is making the civil liberties case here. And civil liberties are important. We can't just suspend them because we don't like who the person is that is whose civil liberties are being violated.
Speaking of civil liberties, the Carter Page FISA warrant documents that were released, and you had not just Adam Schiff, but some Republicans saying that from those documents, the warrant was justified, the surveillance was justified. What was your take from what we could divine from the unredacted portions of those documents?
Well, one thing is clear, and that is the Justice Department should not have withheld some of the crucial information they withheld. They should have disclosed to the court that this dossier was paid for by people who were trying to get Hillary Clinton elected. That is an important fact, and it was left out. They should have also mentioned that the source of the information, the man who wrote the dossier, was also accusing President Trump of salacious conduct in a bedroom in Moscow. And if that had been put in the application, the FISA court might have discredited the source. But they quite deliberately left out the two most damaging facts, and they got the warrant. That's indisputable. The question whether they would have gotten the warrant anyway, I don't know. You know, the FISA court gets out warrants pretty easily, and there's no check and balance there. I, for years, argued that the FISA court, by law, ought to have a devil's advocate. That is somebody who is given security clearance and is paid to make the case against issuing the warrant. So the court hears both sides, but right now they only hear one side.
Well, let me ask you that about the FISA court, just again, your kind of civil libertarian philosophy. This is a recent innovation post Watergate. Should FISA courts be eliminated? Do we need them?
I think they should be changed. I think there should be an adversarial process, and it should be much more transparent. And it shouldn't be appointed by the Chief Justice, because that tends to load the court with people of the Chief Justice's political persuasion. It should be a broader appointing process. So there are a lot of things wrong with the FISA court, and those are institutional. I've been arguing that for years and years and years before President Trump ever even considered running for president. So all the points I'm making are points I've made, some of them for 50 years, but I'm criticized now because I'm making them in the context of Donald Trump. If I were making them in the context of Hillary Clinton, they'd have built a statue to me on Martha's Vineyard, but instead, obviously, many people on the left and liberals are attacking me. You should read some of the emails I'm getting, threatening emails. My family gets threatening emails just because I'm making a civil liberties case that happens to benefit Donald Trump this time, might have benefited Hillary Clinton, and in the future might benefit Bernie Sanders. Who knows?
Maybe.
Are you
maybe
getting police protection?
Not on Martha's Vineyard, no. but actually, when I spoke in New York, I needed police protection, yes. When I made open speeches at events, book signings, etc. But, you know, it's interesting because I've gotten some awards, too. My book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, has become a New York Times bestseller, which means it's being read across the country, not just in one particular region. And so I'm hoping, you know, I wrote it to help educate the American public as to what the criteria for impeachment are. I would have written the same book had Hillary Clinton been elected and being impeached. In fact, my publisher came up with a mock cover called The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton.
just to make the point, because it would have been the same book, except the names would have been changed.
Maybe A.G. Sulzberger will rally to your defense now that you're being threatened the way that he is very concerned about the Fourth Estate and its members. Just lastly, I want to get your take on where you think the Mueller investigation is. The latest, you know, news from around the investigation was Mueller looking or re-looking at Trump tweets that came out last week. Are we just seeing mounting evidence, to the extent evidence of anything has been presented, that Mueller was never needed in the first place to investigate these matters?
I think Mueller was never needed in the first place. But imagine if Mueller had been appointed to investigate President Hillary Clinton, and they were looking at her tweets, and they were looking at her public statements, and they were looking at the fact that she may have, you know, erased emails. Civil libertarians would be up in arms saying this is such a stretch of the obstruction law. But the same civil libertarians are now saying it's okay because they're going after Trump. The idea of putting together an obstruction case based on public tweets, based on public statements. You know, people don't commit obstruction of justice in public. They commit it in private. And so this is such a stretch, and for me, such a show of weakness on the part of what Mueller has been able to put together, if the reporting in the New York Times is accurate.
Well, thank you for what you do. I know it's no fun to be to have to defile yourself to match wits with Avenatti. Well, yeah, but I mean, you have to go on cable TV and sort of subject yourself to Avenatti and Jeffrey Toobin. I mean, you're Alan Dershowitz, for goodness sake.
No, Jeffrey Toobin's a great guy. Avenatti, I'll leave it to the people to judge him.
Yeah, Good.
Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, the New York Times bestseller, is The Case Against Impeaching Trump. Alan, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
All right. So it's called vomit fraud.
Yeah. Vomit fraud.
And Uber drivers are doing it. So if you lose your lunch in an Uber, you know, naturally you have to pay for it because it could be messy.
Right. That's it. That's $50. That's not. That's 100.
It's anywhere from $80 to $150 more. And all people, right. You know, and
that
it's,
was at least $1.60 right there.
But it's
there.
Called vomit fraud because Uber drivers, what they're doing is they're taking a picture. They're sending in fraudulent photos to headquarters so that they get reimbursed right away to clean up the mess when it's actually not happening. No one's getting sick all the time in a car. So it's a scam for them.
That's 100. That was 100.
To make more money, one person, David Schultz, he was charged with a $165 cleaning fee. And Uber responded to his allegations but by sending him two photos. But it didn't look anything like the car that he was in. So he knew right away, but he had to fight them. And fighting them is like fighting City Hall. You get trapped in phone hell. You write email after email. And he finally got his $165 back. But be careful. People have got to check their credit card statements or their debit card.
I'll tell you what, you know, don't you think you have a low enough Uber rating as it is? Now you're exposing the little game that some Uber drivers are running. I mean, they're going to have little pictures of Amy Jacobson in all their cars.
It's getting better slowly, but I had a bad run with a guy named Muhammad in Phoenix that I should tell you about. He grabbed my phone and gave himself a 5-star rating, then gave my phone back, then demanded money.
Bad run with a guy named Muhammad. That could be like a Coen Brothers movie. Bad run with a guy named Muhammad.
In Phoenix.
All right. Well, we'll continue to try and prop you up, get you above 2.0 at some point.
Thanks so much for making this part of Okage.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.